Hey, it's Vince Marotta coming up on Football Friday. The Arizona State Sun Devils have their last ever Pac-12 opener. We'll get into that and preview the D-backs' big series in New York against the Yankees. It's Bickley and Marotta morning, 6 a.m. here on Arizona Sports, the local sports leader.
All righty, Vinny, high noon. We continue to roll through the midday show here. Tim Ringhauer, balls are in for Wolf and Luke, taking up until 2 o'clock. Lots still to come. Chris Cartman, Sun Devil Source, talking some ASU football. That's coming up at 1:15. Cardinals and Cowboys coming up on Sunday in Glendale, 1:25 kickoff. The game can be seen on Fox. Joe Davis, Gerald Moose Johnston on the call. Pam Oliver on the sidelines. Radio, of course, Passion Wolf and Paulie on the sidelines. And the game will be broadcast nationally on the radio, Howard Balzer. Did you know that? The analyst for the game will be Danny White, and the play-by-play guy, a familiar name, Kevin Ray, who does all the Cowboys games on the national radio broadcast. K-Ray, what's up, my man?
Gentlemen, good afternoon to you.
He's a football guy this time of year, that Kevin Ray.
Indeed.
K-Ray, the Cowboys, man, I gave the stat earlier. Fifth team in the Super Bowl era to score at least 70 or more and allow 10 or fewer in the first two games of the season. Small sample size. I mean, let's not go planning the parade yet, but there are two games, I think, of dominance, but I also think of complementary football on both sides of the ball and special teams. What have you seen out of the Cowboys that has been overtly impressive to your eyes through eight quarters of football?
Yeah, I think it is, you know, I was able to get out to training camp for a few days, and even despite, the kind of the wah-wah of the playoff loss to San Francisco last year, what I've seen, Tim and Howard, is a trend of continuing to build up and build ahead. It is without a doubt in the 11 years that I've been doing the games, it's the deepest Cowboys team that they have had in that span. Probably the deepest Cowboys team in 15 years. So that speaks volumes about organizationally what they have done. What I've seen is a team, and not surprisingly, led by Micah Parsons, quickly followed by Dak Prescott, that is hungry, that is like just starving to end this drought. And those two guys have been leaders in the clubhouse about doing that.
And the thing about the defense, and I especially that first game against the Giants, the Giants went right down the field on the first possession of the game and then got to the 8-yard line, had a false start, and then an aborted snap that pushed them back, and then they get a field goal block that's returned for a touchdown, and a couple possessions later, an interception return for a touchdown. They're, like you said, that hunger is leading to these takeaways, which have helped produce these games to get out of hand, and obviously Parsons is front and center with so much of that. Another game with two sacks. Already has 10 games in his career with two sacks, which is tied for fifth all time. I mean, this guy, when you see him on a, I know I'm rambling here to get to a question, Kevin, but when you see him on a week to week basis, is it even almost impossible to explain just what he's capable of doing on a football field? Consistent.
Yeah, I mean, what I have seen and started seeing shades of it last year, and I've kind of held off. Like Danny White and I have had these camp conversations off air and kind of privately. But look, Danny White knows. Danny White played against some dude who wore 56. And it's easy, for people to hear a guy like me say, well, you're a homer. But if you've listened to any of the national talk shows over the last, 2 weeks, and to some degree even late last season, the comparisons to that dude, his initials being LT, are spot on. And the way that he carries himself, but like I say, what it goes back to me is, just this hunger to be the greatest, the hunger to be the best. You know, one of his great quotes in the offseason, you hear how aggressive he is, but he said, you know, last year I was just getting started. Like this year, he said, I want to take people into the deep water. You know, so he has bad intentions for anybody that is on the offensive side of the football.
K-Ray, where's the, if there is one, where's the hole in the Death Star for the Cardinals to pull off an upset here? Is there a pathway for victory? Now, the Cardinals, I don't know if you had a chance to look at the tape from last week. For 2.5 quarters, their offense was really, really good, and their defense wasn't too far behind. Kind of got away from them in the second half against the Giants, but at least they showed signs of life on offense last week. Is there any pathway to victory for the Cardinals here? Any vulnerability that you see with the Dallas Cowboys through 2 weeks that maybe the Cards could exploit?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's always a level of vulnerability. And look, you can say this for every matchup each week. It starts with turnovers. You know, Cowboys have been great at taking care of the football. They've been, you know, fanatical about taking away the football. But, you know, there's no guarantee that happens every week. I think for Mike McCarthy and this coaching staff, I'm sure that they have had the full attention of their team for the very reason that you mentioned, Tim, because realistically, the Cardinals could, and in many respects should, be coming into this game unbeaten. And I understand, you know, it's four quarters that you have to play. But my guess is this coaching staff has said, look, this team has played well enough to build leads, you know, to have leads in the second half and leads, you know, closing out the third quarter of games. So let's not take anything for granted. And this goes back to the hunger, not only for Micah Parsons, but just this team. Because when they look back last year, yes, they had 12 wins, but they were in a position to win 14, even 15 games, because they blew second half leads. And I think that there's a carryover from that. But the bottom line is they know each week you've got to play top flight football, because you look on the other side of the field, those dudes are wearing NFL jerseys, which means they're there for a reason. And while they may not be household names, they're still guys. And I look at a guy like Josh Dobbs. You know, I mean, this guy also has a burning hunger. James Conner, look how hard he runs. So my guess is, you know, for the Cowboys, they can't be their own worst enemy.
And I think, Kevin, as the Cowboys watch the tape from last week's game, of the Cardinals, of course, is what they looked at was the 31 points and the 358 yards that the Giants put up in the second half. And so Tell our listeners about, you got Pollard, the running back, the three receivers that are really good, going against a Cardinals defense that is struggles in the secondary. I mean, they won't have Buda Baker. Got a young promising guy in Keytrell Clark on one of the corners. But and when they move Jalen Thompson into the slot, they're playing two safeties, Andre Sachere and Kayvon Wallace, who prior to this season hardly ever really played that much on defense. I would think that Cowboys are looking at this and saying, this is what we can exploit and what a challenge it'll be for the Cardinals.
Yeah, and look, let me say first and foremost, I'm really bummed that Buda Baker is not going to play, because I'm a huge Buda Baker fan, man. This guy has a motor and plays the game the right way, so it's unfortunate that he's not going to be on the field. But you do point out some vulnerabilities that, you know, you would think that the Cowboys will try to target. And, you know, that's the thing. Like, this team offensively hasn't had a whole lot of people talking, and, you know, rightfully so when you look at what the defense has done. You know, offensively, they didn't do much. They didn't need much in week one. So this is an offense that's still growing. And by the way, they were down two offensive linemen last week. It looks like Tyler Smith, the second year man out of Tulsa, will be on the field. So they'll move him back in at left guard. So their offensive line should be as close to whole as possible. Brandon Cooks didn't play last week. He's trending towards being on the field. So offensively, I think there is a chance for this Dallas offense to really continue to take another step as they did coming off of a very challenging Jets defense last week.
Kevin Ray, thanks for the time, man. Have a good call on Sunday. Before I let you go, 12 days, K-Ray, 12 days until the Suns open training camp, my man.
Oh, yeah, brother. It's on the calendar. I'm X-ing it off, baby.
I'm bursting, baby. I'm bursting.
I'm right there with you.
All right, K-Ray. All right, Kevin Ray, voice of the Dallas Cowboys national radio broadcast, and, of course, the voice of the great Phoenix Suns. Tim Ring, our Bulls are coming up after the timeout. Final nine of the regular season for the D-backs kicks off tomorrow in the Bronx. We'll set the table. We'll hear from Torrey Lovello, Corbin Carroll. It's all coming up after the timeout. Tim and Howard in for Wolf and Luke, Arizona Sports, the local sports leader.
Cardinals fans, this is your night. The Big Red Rage, coming up tonight at 6 on the home of Arizona Cardinals football, 98.7 in the Arizona Sports app.
All right, Tim Ring, Howard Balzer in with you here on a Thursday. Wolf and Luke with the day off. They are TCBing. Howard Balzer taking care of business along with Aaron Maloney today. They will be back tomorrow, and we will all be better off for it. Howard, real quick, before we get into the D-backs, did you see this latest Deion Sanders news and note coming out of Boulder, Colorado? Deion, as you know, last week was in the news. Well, he's always been in the news.
Yeah, exactly.
But he was in the news more so than usual because of the whole Jay Norvell, Colorado State. I take my sunglasses and hat off when I speak to other people. My mama taught me that. And Deion, of course, ran with that. Used it as an opportunity to promote his sunglass brand. He gave sunglasses to his entire team. He gave them all to his the game day people and the Fox people that were there in Boulder. And he also walked around telling everybody it's personal. It's personal now, the game with Colorado State. Deion just filed a trademark application for the phrase, it's personal.
Oh, my goodness.
Deion Sanders, never change. All right, hey, we're going to give away some Cardinal Cowboy tickets. Two tickets to see the Cardinals take on the Cowboys this Sunday at State Farm Stadium. Right now, caller number six, Jesse. Caller number six, 602-260-9870. We'll score two tickets to see the Cardinals take on the Cowboys this Sunday at State Farm Stadium. Once again, caller number six, call 602-260-9870, and you can win a pair of tickets to see the Cowboys and the Cardinals on Sunday in Glendale. Caller number six. All right, Howard, let's talk some baseball real quick. Special thanks, by the way, to Kevin Ray for coming out and talking some Cardinals and Cowboys. K-Ray on the call on the national radio broadcast for all the Cowboys games each and every Sunday with former ASU great Danny White. All right, for the D-backs now, Howard, let's set the table. In the wild card race, they're 2.5 back of Philly. They have a lead over the Cubs that right now is, where is it at over the Cubs?
Game and a half.
Game and a half over the Cubs. The Cubs play the Pirates later today. The Phillies host the Mets later today. That Phillies-Mets game is on Fox. So with the D-backs off today, if you want to keep track and maybe hold out hope the D-backs can actually catch the Phillies and finish with the number one wild card spot, well, the Mets could do the Diamondbacks a whole lot of good over these last week plus of the over the last week plus of the season, because the Mets and Phillies play a bunch between now and the end of the season. They play tonight in Philly. The game is on Fox. D-backs are off. The Cubs play the Pirates, the Marlins, and the Reds are off as well. The D-backs back on the field tomorrow, Yankee Stadium, the Bronx, first of three. It's a weekend set against the Yankees. Then it's three against the White Sox in Chicago, and then back home for three against the Houston Astros at Chase Field. So, Howard, you credit the D-backs for time and time again. And this is basically post-All-Star break, because prior to the All-Star break, they were nothing but up in this baseball season. But after the All-Star break, every time you think they're down and out for good, like a phoenix, they rise from the ashes, and they put themselves right back in a position to make the postseason. And that's exactly where they are at right now, at 81-72, certainly in position now. If it doesn't all fall apart, Derek Hall said, hey, watch yourself, it could fall apart. Thanks a lot, President Hall, for putting that bad juju out there. But he's right, though. If you don't continue to play good baseball, and you finish 2-7 in your last nine, you may finish up on the wrong side of this playoff race. But right now, it looks like the D-backs, after that disastrous series in New York, found their footing again. And they sweep back-to-back series against the Giants and the Cubs to the tune of a five-game winning streak as they head to the Bronx.
And they started August, what, losing their first nine games. And so
they did,
it's
yes.
It's been the story since the All-Star break, and for a lot of the teams, we've talked about that you always have to be mindful of a collapse coming. We've seen it in baseball. I'm not going to say time and time again, but it does happen. And it could happen to any one of these teams. I mean, hey Tim, I'll go way back in time, 59 years ago,
okay,
because it's the Phillies. The Phillies had a six, and this is when there was only one team from each league. It was only eight teams in each league, right? They had a 6.5 game lead with 12 games to play, and they proceeded to lose 10 in a row.
I'm going to hop on here for just a second.
The Phillies have 10 games left. Hey, maybe they'll lose them all.
I think Torrey Lovello should remind the ball club of that what happened 59 years ago.
You just never know.
Or the 69,
you just
the
never, six, ever know.
The 69 Cubs, I think, is
there
the
we go. Another
collapse.
Good example. Yep.
Yes, Jesse.
This is not me calling you old, Howard, but I do enjoy every time that you're in here that I, you know, get a history lesson each time I'm in here. You always bring up something that I've never learned before, and I always learn it. I enjoy learning things.
And the crazy part about that, I should go, I don't want to go too far in the weeds here, but the game that started the 10-game losing streak for them was a 1-0 loss to the Cincinnati Reds on a straight steal of home by the Hall of Famer Chico Ruiz. A straight steal of home. And they won 1-0. That started the 10-game fall. Dick Allen, by the way, was a rookie that year for the Phillies. But again, the point is, you just never know what's going to happen. You can never assume. And crazy things can happen. And that's why you just have to do your own job, pay attention to your own. Don't worry about everybody else. Just win games and do what you've been doing for the last five and for a lot of other stretches this season.
Of course not. Who could forget the 1938 Pirates, who on the morning of September 2nd owned a 7-game lead in the National League, and they lost 8 of their next 11 games and blew the pennant. The 1938 Pirates, Howard.
Remember that season of several? I forget how many. Maybe when the Rockies won, like, gosh, it was just ridiculous.
Remember it? I worked for the team. I was a broadcaster for that team.
Okay. Well, there you go. I mean, last year the Cardinals were out of it, and I think they won like 16 games in a row.
The Rockies, Rocktober, even though it was September, they won 14 of their last 15 just to force a play-in game to get to the playoffs, and the rest is history. They went on to the World Series. All right, so let's hear from Torrey Lovello, Jesse, talking about what this team feels confidence-wise after sweeping these last two series.
I would say it's very high, but it's been high. It's even in times when things weren't going well. You know, I think we have moments of being playing in a lull. The New York series towards the end of the last game, I think we were definitely in a little bit of a lull. But when we came back here, we came out on the baseball field like we never lost a baseball game all year. And that's one of the unbelievable qualities of this team. They're just adjustable, adaptable. They're committed. And I think when you combine a lot of the things that we talk about here, you flush and go. You flush it and move on. And I think they're just innately a bunch of confident baseball players.
You know what I think is a perfect example of that, what he was just saying, Tim? And who knows how much this game has jump-started everything we've seen just in the last few, was that win over the Cubs in 13 innings. I mean, that was just off the chain. When you fall behind, what was it, three extra innings when you fall behind in each one, and then two of them you come back and tie it, and then the last one you come back and win it?
Yeah.
That was the epitome of what he was just talking about. Just think, if you just lose that game and everything is still the same now, I mean, what the heck? I mean, they'd be a half game behind the Cubs, I think.
Well, there's been a few of those games. I mean, the 8-7 win over the Reds, or excuse me, the 4-3 win over the Texas Rangers in 11 innings back on Monday, October 21st. That was a game to remember. And there have been just certain benchmark games throughout the second half of the season where, again, The D-backs look to be down and out, maybe not coming back. Go back and search how many "the D-backs are dead, it's over" tweets from members of the media back in August. And it, to be fair, at times it really did look like that. But this team, again, every time you think they're down and out, they get back off the mat and they start playing good baseball again. The problem is, every time there's a peak, there's been a valley coming right after.
That's what I was just going to... Yeah.
You hope with these last nine games, bingo, there's not a valley coming to finish it out. All right, Jesse, what do we got here? Text us your thoughts, FanDuel text line at 620-620 right now. All right, we're taking a break. When we come back to some Cardinal football, a lot of talk about what went wrong last week in the second half against the New York Giants as the Cardinals collapse and get outscored 31-8 in the second half. How much of it do you put on an inexperienced coaching staff, and what does that mean if you do going forward for Jonathan Gannon, Nick Rawls, and Drew Petsing? We'll get Howard's thoughts on that. Talk some Cardinal football coming up after the timeout. Tim and Howard in for Wolf and Luke, Arizona Sports, the local sports leader.
Hey, it's Gambo. The Diamondbacks are hot following their fifth straight win. Given their remaining schedule, how secure is their spot in the postseason? We'll tell you on today's Burns and Gambo show, starting at straight up 2 o'clock.
All right, Burns and Gambo, just about 90 minutes away. Looking forward to that. For now, the Wolf and Luke show continues on. Tim Ringhauer, balls are up until 2 o'clock. Sun Devil football talk with Chris Cartman coming up at 1:15 as the Sun Devils have a massive, titanic task at hand coming up Saturday night at Mountain America Stadium. Caleb Williams and the USC Trojans are in town as ASU tries to somehow compete and maybe steal an upset. But boy, that will be easier said than done. We'll talk to Chris about that coming up in just a bit. Speaking of college football, Howard, I mentioned that Deion Sanders, after the verbal kerfuffle with Jay Norvell last week, has filed for a trademark for the phrase, "it's personal." Right on cue, a story just broke from Fox LA. The sunglasses that Deion partnered with, that company, since they partnered with Deion, $4.8 million in sales. Nearly $5 million.
And sunglasses.
I mean,
man,
Deion Sanders, yeah, he's a brand. Nobody quite has ever done it Deion.
What's the over-under on how long he's going to be at Colorado?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, let's see how many games he wins this year.
Yeah. They got a couple... tough stretch in the next two games.
They do.
They have Oregon and SC, right?
They do, but they're obviously way better than people thought going in.
No doubt.
I'm going to guess, Howard, I mean, Colorado's, if you're winning there, Boulder's a beautiful place to live. You know, would there be greater compensation for him at other schools? Probably.
Maybe not.
Right, but he's well compensated there. I mean, if I had a guess, it'd be two seasons and out. But if you're winning and you're recruiting and your quality of life is good, you know, I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, I've lived in that area. It's phenomenal. Boulder, Colorado is beautiful. That whole area is phenomenal. The weather's great. It's a fantastic place to live. So I don't know. We'll see. But they're obviously far more prestigious programs in college football than CU. But what kind of job openings are there going to be at said prestigious programs? You know, if Nick Saban were to retire after the year, Deion's not a candidate at Alabama. I don't see that. If Mike Norvell moved on from Florida State, would Deion be a candidate at Florida State? Absolutely. So we'll see. We'll see what options he has. But I would say 2 years would probably be it for him in Boulder, but you just don't know what the other factors are. You know, plus, is he going to, you know, when his son moves on, you know, what's his level of interest going to be with the current roster that he has there in Boulder? And we'll see how well he recruits. And I'm going to guess he's going to recruit awfully well. All right, Howard, let's get into this Cardinal thing real quick before we are up against a break. Now, the Cardinals, they lost these two games that they had leads in the fourth quarter. And whereas the Washington Commanders loss, you say, listen, Josh Dobbs fumbled the football twice, gave the Commanders two short fields, led to 10 points. Those 10 points were the difference in the game. A little more complicated when you look at what happened on both sides of the ball for the final quarter and a half against the Giants. The defense couldn't stop the Giants in the second half. five possessions, touchdown, 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 field goal, ball game. But offensively, outside of the opening touchdown of the third quarter for the Cardinals, that offense completely went into a shell. My question to you is, and I think it's fair, Jonathan Gannon came up after the game and said, we got outcoached. I got outcoached. Like, he owned it. He wore it. So I'm wondering now, you got a first-time head coach, a first-time offensive coordinator, first-time defensive coordinator. How much did inexperience in those positions play a role in a second half collapse that, man, you don't see too often in the National Football League?
I'm sure it probably contributed, and they are going through these roles for the first time. And all the coaches, I mean, the coordinators spoke to the media on Tuesday, and they all do the combination falling on the sword of saying, I wish I had called better plays, but then they also say it comes down to execution, and that's truly what separates in the NFL is players making plays or not making plays. And I've always believed this, Tim, and here's something I said to a lot of people before the season even started when they say, what do you think the Cardinals are going to be like this year? I said, I don't think they're going to be as bad as people think. I think they're going to play teams tough, but I think a lot of times what will happen, you'll get a close game, but in the second half or late in the game, the other team's talent will win out. And the other team will just show why they are the better team. And I think that's what we've seen the first 2 weeks. There's an inherent assumption when a coach says, well, I wish I'd called better plays on this or that one or whatever it might be. There's an inherent assumption if you'd called something different, the result would have been different. You don't know that. You don't know that. You might have called something different and the same result might have occurred. So I've always been a believer it comes down to players and execution and who makes play. And the Giants just made a ton of plays, obviously, especially on offense, in that second half that the Cardinals defense had no answer for, whatever it was, whether it was running Barkley, throwing it to Barkley, throwing it to the receivers, Daniel Jones running, they just couldn't stop it. The flip side was that the interesting thing in that game is the Giants, the three Cardinals touchdown drives, when those happen, the two best defensive linemen the Giants have, Dexter Lawrence and Leonard Williams, weren't on the field. They were there for most of the others, and they were doing in the rotation, and that had an effect. Though I'm sure at the end of the game, especially in the fourth quarter, those main guys are on the field. And so that bottles up James Conner. I mentioned earlier, he had five consecutive, his last six carries went for 3 yards, but his last one was a 3 yard run. Before that, his five carries were all either zero or minus one or one. And so the Giants were stopping what the Cardinals had done earlier. And when you do that and you get some false starts and this happens and that happens and it just all bogs down. So I still think at the end of the day, though, Tim, it comes down to talent and talent wins out. And that's why you see teams exert their will a lot of times in the fourth quarter when they're just better than the other team.
Good news, though, the way the Cardinals came out of the gates in week one and week two, clearly preparation was good. Game plan was good. Execution was certainly good offensively. Yes. Defensively, both games early on. So, but in week two against the Giants, Drew Petsing put together a game plan, and Josh Dobbs and that offensive unit came out there and executed it. And for 2.5 quarters, they were outstanding. And I mentioned it on the postgame show. Darren Urban's covered this team for almost a quarter century. Said that might have been one of the best halves of football he's ever seen this team play. Think about that. As talent deficient as this team currently is, a guy who's covered this team for that long said that might have been one of the best halves of football he's ever seen this team play. So from a game plan and a preparation standpoint, clearly these young coordinators and this young head coach are doing something right. But when things go south, especially in week two, they didn't have an answer.
Right. And that's definitely, I asked Nick Rallis, the defensive coordinator, and he was taught this and that, calling play. I said, how difficult a challenge it is. I mean, so many of the yards, the Giants I mentioned had 358 yards in the second half. 245 were on first downs. They had, and that's a tough, you know, in terms of what you call on defense, that's an open book in what the other team is going to do on first and 10. And they just shredded the Cardinals on first down. So is that the call that was wrong, or is it just the Giants capitalized and made those plays? Heck, the first play of the second half, throw it down the field, and the receiver just beat Marco Wilson at a 58-yarder on first down in a sense, opened the floodgates for what happened in the second half. So yeah. I think essentially, like I said, it comes down to players, and they're shorthanded in the secondary. They became shorthanded on the defensive line. And I think as the game wears on, those things come to the fore even more.
All right, listen today and tomorrow at 7:20 a.m., 12:20 p.m., and 5:20 p.m. as we are giving you the chance to win tickets to see the Cardinals take on the Cowboys. Be caller number 10 when you hear your cue to call in, and you will score two tickets to the big game. We're taking a timeout. We're going to continue to talk some football after the break. If you did not know it, Howard Balzer here is on the Hall of Fame Selection Committee, and a bunch of nominees were recently named for the next class, and there were a bunch of familiar names. We'll get Howard's thoughts on what former Cardinals could make their way to Canton sooner than later. We're taking a break. Tim and Howard in for Wolf and Luke. It's Arizona Sports, the local sports leader.
Hey all, Dan Bickley here, and join us for another Football Friday as the Cardinals prep for the Cowboys in a road game in Glendale. Bickley and Murata morning starting at 6 on Arizona Sports, the local sports leader.
Tim Ray, Howard Balzer in for Wolf and Luke here. It's 12:48 on a Thursday. A couple days ago, the story came out about the 173 modern era nominees to the Pro Football Hall of Fame as members of the 2024 class. So even though it came out a couple days ago, we want to touch on this today because my man here, my partner, Howard Balzer, is a longtime member of the Hall of Fame committee. So he can speak, he can, with great knowledge, with an educated opinion, can speak on what goes into getting these guys to Canton, what it may take, what the hurdles may be for specific players, and the like. So the former Cardinals that were nominated, certainly some of these guys, longtime Cardinals, some not so much. Larry Centers, Anquan Boldin, Tim McDonald, John Abraham, Dwight Freeney, Simeon Rice, Carlos Dansby, Antonio Cromartie, and Jeff Feagles. Guys like Freeney and Cromartie played a total of, you know, one season each year, and obviously guys like Boldin and Centers were more longtime Arizona Cardinals. So, you know, Howard, we're not going to go through every name. We don't have time. But let me start with Anquan Boldin. Not the first time he's been a nominee. In fact, he's been a semifinalist before. What is it going to take to get Q into the Hall of Fame if he, in fact, will get there someday? Your thoughts?
The hardest thing for receivers is that there's so many. And when you look at Anquan, I think he's right there with a lot of guys. What we've seen the last few years, he was a semifinalist a couple of years. But you've had Torrey Holt and Reggie Wayne, who have been four-time finalists. And Andre Johnson has been a two-time finalist. And they haven't gotten in. And so what ends up happening is somebody else doesn't break into that final group until one of them gets elected. Now, in a couple of years, Larry Fitzgerald will leapfrog whoever has been in the key. But that those are special circumstances. And so with Boldin, it's a matter of getting one of these other guys in, and maybe he jumps in. I mean, heck, there's Steve Smith. A lot of people think Steve Smith should be in there and should be being considered. And he's a guy that could jump into that 15 that hasn't yet because of what happens when you have a logjam like that at one particular position. So
it's like it's like planes on the runway waiting to take
off. And all those things enter into how, when guys get in, of who else is at your position. And it's hard to make that list of 15 finalists, and then obviously to be the five that go in. I mean, it's really hard. And so, but I think Anquan has a shot, you know, down the road, and, you know, we'll see how it plays out. But got to get one of these other guys in that has been waiting as long as they have.
The other guy I wanted to ask you about is Carlos Dansby. And Dansby is an interesting case to me. I thought Dansby was a hell of a football player, a great linebacker, part of the Cardinals kind of resurgence or surgence, if you will, his first stint. His 2013 season here was phenomenal. For the first 8 weeks of the season, I thought he was a candidate for Defensive Player of the Year. The downside to Dansby, to me, I'm glad he's a nominee. I never thought Carlos Dansby, Hall of Famer. But then again, I got to tell you, Howard, compare Dansby's career stats to Zach Thomas, who just went in this past year. I don't say Dansby blows him away, but he's significantly, statistically speaking, better than Zach Thomas in almost every category. Since Thomas just went in, what does that mean for Dansby? And for the people that are on the Hall of Fame committee and the voters, do they look at that? Do they say, hey, listen, we just put Zach Thomas in. If we're going, Zach Thomas might have a better story, right? Fifth round pick, Texas Tech. Nobody expected much out of him. Yada yada yada. You know, undersized guy. You know, tough as nails. Kind of had a lot more fanfare about him than Dansby. But it shouldn't just be about the story when it comes to Hall of Fame. It should also be about production, obviously. So, do voters and the people that make the ultimate decisions here, will they look at Zach Thomas and say, "We put this dude in. Look at Dansby's numbers. We better put this dude in."
I think it comes down to someone has to take up the cause for certain players. There was a guy in the Rams, London Fletcher, who was just an amazing player for a long time. He didn't make the semifinals for the first 4 or 5 years of his eligibility. And a couple of people, including myself, quite honestly, sent a letter to everybody on the committee and say, take a closer look at this guy. And boom, he was a semifinalist last year. Sometimes that's what it takes. And when you have a guy who hasn't played, you know, it's been at least 5 years and sometimes more. And when a guy doesn't make the first cut to the semis some years, they kind of get, quote, lost in the cracks. And so it's up to someone to take up his cause to kind of alert the committee to really look close. Because realistically, I mean, you have 107. People forget. 173. I was looking at this, Tim. The most nominees there's been in the last 10 years was 130 in 2021. Last year, there's 129. People in the public, and someone from the Hall of Fame told me this because I asked them. They said, "I think we have to look a little closer at who we, at what the, what you have to do to be." When someone anyone in the public can nominate somebody, you could send an email to the Hall of Fame and say, "I nominate whoever," and then they'll look at it. And there are some standards, but they're saying that, hey, maybe we need to
tighten it up.
So 173, and realistically, we all are working. We're all doing things. We don't have time to just delve into 173 guys. And a lot of times you look at, oh, who were the semifinalists last year? And then you start looking closer, maybe some other guys. But that's what happens. We're always sending notes to each other about, take a look at this guy. How about this guy? That happens quite frequently. And that's what'll have to happen, at least to get him to move along in the process and be considered. I mean, the year before, Sam Mills. I mean, does his name scream out Hall of Fame when you hear him? Really good player.
Only because of the undersized 5'7" story.
Right. And he was a heck of a player.
And a good, great player too. Obviously.
And he got noted. He wasn't a semifinalist for like the first 10 to 14 years of his career, and then he got elected in his final year of modern day eligibility. So a lot of times that's what it takes. Everson Walls, a cornerback, he was never a finalist. Hey, last year Albert Lewis, one of the great corners of all time, was never a finalist in his 15 in his 20 years of modern. Once his last year, that was the first time he was a finalist, and everyone was said, hey, take a look at this closer, and that's the reality of the process. And so, like I said, not to repeat myself, but someone has to take up the cause for Carlos, and perhaps that gets people to notice him a little more and says, hey, yeah, this guy's deserving.
Real quick before we hit the break, so the nominees are out, 173. What's the next step, and when does that take place?
We will vote. We haven't been given a date yet, but normally it'll be sometime in October, and everyone will vote for the top 25, and then that's announced in November. So,
okay. So it goes from 173 to
set to 25. Yes. Yeah, and then to 15 after that for the final vote. Another guy real quick, Simeon Rice. I had guys on the Buccaneers tell me that, and this is Derek Brooks. This was Warren Sapp. This was Rondé Barber telling me that we really took off when Simeon Rice came to us from the Cardinals. And he's been a semifinalist a couple times, has never been advanced beyond that. When he was with the Cardinals, the team wasn't very good. And that affected him. I think that affected Aeneas Williams a certain amount of times in his career because he was with the Cardinals and they weren't that good a team.
Nobody ever saw him play.
Yeah, that's basically it. And when
he
came up, I was shocked that he didn't advance in the process because I was there in St. Louis when he came to the Rams. And so I sent out and spoke to Dave McGinnis about Aeneas Williams, who said to me this. He said, he was the Bears linebackers coach during his heyday. He says, I thought I would never coach another player with the ability, the drive, the passion, the smarts than Mike Singletary until I coached Aeneas Williams. And I wrote that all up, sent it, and boom, all of a sudden he moved on in the process. So a lot of times that's what it takes.
All right, we're taking a timeout. Tick tock, tick tock. tick-tock. Cardinal fans waiting for the return of Kyler Murray. And Kyler Murray perhaps puts a hint out on TikTok. Tim and Howard in for Wolf and Luke, Arizona Sports, the local sports leader.